everybody. I'm Alex. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me, and thanks, Justin, for riding up with me. I didn't have to think about what I was going to say. My sobriety date is April 21st, 1993. I have a sponsor. I sponsor guys. My home group is the Buford Road Group. We meet there in the Bonaire side of Richmond Wednesdays at 7. If you're in the vicinity, please come by. Thanks, Hillbilly. I'm just calling you that because that's how I have you in my cell phone. If he ever calls you, you know, the last name comes up first on the caller ID, Hillbilly. Yeah, probably, it's still novel to me. You've probably been going through that for a while. But I'm glad to be here. And I heard something, this guy, I don't know if he's aware of it or not, but he shared it 2 weeks in a row at my home group, but I really liked it. And this is just an illustration of my thinking, and I don't know, maybe alcoholics' thinking, but certainly of my thinking. But he talked about sitting around the house with his wife and saying, hey, let's go see such and such a movie tonight. Let's go out and, you know, get out of the house and go do something. No, I don't want to. His reaction in here, I want a divorce. Yeah, and I'm like, that's me, you know, that is just so me. And I've laughed about that both weeks. Maybe we'll hear it 3 weeks in a row coming up. I don't know, but anyway, you know, I didn't grow up with an alcoholic background. I had, my father's passed away, but I had my dad and my mom, who's still living, and one sister who's 3 years younger than I am. None of them alcoholic. All of them, well, he drank, and they still drink. So we had liquor around and beer and whatever. That kind of thing growing up, I guess you'd say middle class. We lived in a neighborhood. I had friends. You know, we just rode our bikes around and did that kind of stuff. It was just, to me, a normal kind of childhood growing up. I hear a lot of folks talk about the, you know, from the very beginning they felt different. And I absolutely, I've heard that enough times, I absolutely believe it. And maybe I just haven't come to realize that yet, but things seemed pretty normal to me growing up as a kid. For the most part. I mean, you know, some insecurities, and I can't play football, and the important people are playing football, and, you know, that kind of stuff. But most of it was piddly. I had my group of friends, and we had fun. And, you know, I had good examples in my life growing up, and my parents, who were married almost 50 years, never saw them argue, not even once. And, you know, my mom wasn't... isn't, you know, a cowering in the corner type of person at all, but I never, ever saw them argue once. Never saw either one of them drunk. You know, missed my opportunity of seeing my dad drunk. Well, at least heavily buzzed. And I was angry because I could have seen it, picking him up from the airport. I guess he had too many in the lounge or something, but, what I'm getting at with all that is I, you know, came into this life and was sort of brought along with every opportunity somebody could want. You know, I didn't have everything that I wanted. I don't want to present it like that. But, you know, I didn't get the Schwinn bicycle. Mine was from Sears. that kind of stuff. Maybe that's an old resentment. Maybe I ought to get, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I had a good life growing up. And I did try... different things, sports-wise, and we went on trips and all this. It was just a good family to grow up in. We went to church, and I didn't mind that so much until I got a little older. But in any event, the first time that I can remember feeling the effects of alcohol, and I always wish I could come up with a new way to tell the first time, you know, but there isn't a new way. It's the first time. You know, I was at some friends of mine's house up the street, and we liked to go up there because it was a single mom, and she was working or dating or doing whatever, so we pretty much had free rein. And, you know, we were very bad. We'd make prank phone calls and listen to albums. You know, we were really destroying the place. But one afternoon, I don't remember what instigated this, but I remember there was a bottle of whiskey underneath the kitchen sink in the cabinet. And I remember whoever's idea it was, let's mix drinks. You know, and we don't know anything about mixing drinks. So we got the big plastic, I guess stadium cups, they call them now. But got those things, and it was whiskey and iced tea. You know, and mixing it up. And, you know, I don't know if my life changed at that moment, but I remember liking it. I remember getting a buzz off of it. The music sounded better. You know, and it was one of those all-in-one stereos that had the 8-track and the cassette and the turntable. The speakers looked very impressive, but they probably were worth about $2.50. You know, but I remember drinking that and feeling some effect. I mean, I didn't know what drunk was or what alcohol was going to do to me or for me or, you know, out of the gate. And it was a lot of fun. I don't remember saying to myself, I'm going to do this every chance I can get. But what would end up happening is that within a couple of years, that's what I would automatically gravitate to. You know, and I would never, it's kind of throughout the story, it's not like this is what I'm going to do. It's just where I went. And, you know, I got into high school, and that came, and I made all of the drinking age changes. So it was, you know, we had people in high school legally buying alcohol. I had a fake ID anyway, but being able to legally buy alcohol. And it was funny because I heard a guy the other night, I don't remember what meeting it was anyway, he was talking about this particular 7-Eleven on Arch Road. And that was the first place I ever bought beer underage, and it was notorious because there was a lot of my friends lived around there. It was kind of funny, but so I'm into high school, and you know, the what really propelled my drinking. And now I was an average student, very average. I wasn't in advanced classes. I liked fun teachers, and I hated the strict ones. You know, and I got C's and some B's and a D here or there. So it's just completely middle of the road. But I got involved in athletics, in running, track and cross country and that kind of thing. And that just sort of automatically came with a whole group of people to run with. Not, well, literally, but, you know, whoever's parents were liberal, whoever's parents were out of town, whatever was going on, we're having a party at the Legion Hall. You know, Tom and his band are going to play. Let's get some kegs. You know, it was just that kind of stuff went on just about every weekend. And back then, for me, you know, getting a six-pack of, you know, whatever it was enough. Or at the keg party, you know, 4 cups of beer of the big cups. And I wasn't even counting. I'm looking back, trying to say, yeah, how much was I having? How much was I doing? And it really wasn't a large amount. I didn't suffer any consequences from drinking in high school. What I suffered consequences of in high school was my attitude about class and about athletics and stuff. And I can't sit here and tell you or stand here and tell you that because I started getting drunk that I didn't care about this stuff anymore. What I can say is that I started to really become separate from what was going on. And I really became the type of person who was more of a victim and less of a participant. You know, it was the circumstances that did this. This teacher is a you-know-what. This is, you know, too difficult for me. You know, my French teacher got committed. That's why I got thrown out of French. You know, and all these ridiculous stories and rationales and reasonings. So bad, in fact, that I had to go to summer school just so I could run. I don't remember if it was my junior or senior year. So my attitude started to change, and I didn't even notice it, you know, really. Where drinking exploded for me, and I can remember getting drunk in high school, you know, just, you know, it's driving around and playing tapes and all this other stuff. But where my drinking really became something different was when high school ended. You know, we went to Beach Week, and it was a whole nothing but an alcoholic haze the entire time. But we had a right to do that. So there was no, you know, looking glass on us or anything like that. I got out of high school really without any ambition. I mean, I'm not skilled in anything except maybe lying and troublemaking and, you know, I'd have a hard time driving a nail straight. You know, I might could change the air filter on a car. You know, that kind of thing. It's not quite that bad, but pretty close. And, you know, I got to the end of high school, and I'm just like, what's next? You know, my dad, who was a great dad, he was, you know, in Korea and in the military and a football coach, teacher, salesman, business owner. I mean, he'd done like all kinds of stuff, and you would have thought I'd have been, you know, whip strapped, but it wasn't that way. But he said, you know, you really ought to go to college. And I kind of knew that was going on because you had to submit applications and stuff like that. But, you know, I sent off applications and one school let me in because I really plummeted my grades my junior year. And when I went to school, you know, it was the difference between night and day. And really two things that I can identify out of the gate. Number one, parental supervision, gone. Problem solved. You know, number two was I could drink whenever I wanted without anybody eagle-eyeing me. Glad you could make it. I went. Your husband told me to say that. It might have been. You know, but I had no, you know, it was complete freedom as far as I was concerned. And I took full advantage of that. And, you know, not really having desired, I wasn't against college, but it was just like next step. You know, not having the ambition of trying to pursue something, I'm taking full advantage of whatever opportunities I can get while still trying to maintain this semblance of responsibility. And I started running there, too, which actually probably kept me in school a lot longer than I would have been. But, you know, nearly immediately, it was drink as much as you could, you know, drinking games, beer bongs, all this stuff. I started passing out and blacking out and waking up with charge slips in my pocket from the night before from the judicial police or whatever they were called on campus. You know, look what happened to me. They said, I said this. It's a whole five paragraphs of all these profanities, you know, and stuff. And, you know, it was amusing. It wasn't affecting me at all, and it probably got me some attention from some of my friends, and they thought that was great. And, you know, eventually, just doing that sort of month after month after month after month after month, I got through my first year. You know, if you're on break, it's nothing but drinking. And I hung around with the people that did the same thing. At least I thought they were doing the same thing. You know, go up to Daryl's, go down to Penny Lane, go to these different bars, somebody's house, just get as drunk as possible. And still not really any consequences. It just, you know, it was like I was saying before, it just sort of took over. That wasn't my intention, but I loved getting drunk. I loved getting drunk. And, you know, it was the drunker the better and the louder the better and all that stuff. And, you know, I would have what should have been an enormous wake-up call while I was still in school. We got in a car accident on 64. I wasn't driving this time, but this is the buffoonery and the stupidity of a budding alcoholic sitting in a bar in Richmond dating a girl from Waynesboro, and it's late. You know what I mean? The sun is not still up by a long shot. And I was driving to Waynesboro. You know? I mean, I woke up behind an elementary school up there one Sunday morning, and you know, all kinds of ridiculous stuff. But this particular time, he was driving, my friend Mark, and we didn't make it back. And we flipped the Chevette over the guardrail into a tree on 64. And I was out for 3 or 4 days. I woke up at my parents' house with, like, some flowers and little stuffed animals that come on the sticks and with the flowers and stuff like that. And I have no idea what's going on, you know, and my sister's friends are coming by to see me and stuff like that. And it's just like, you know, what happened? And, you know, we went by the tow yard on the way back to school after break and to look at the car. I don't know if that, obviously that was intentional on the parental side of things, but the ironic thing about it is we saw the car, I went into the dashboard, we didn't have seatbelts on, I went into the dashboard about that high above the dashboard, and it was like, man, that's bad, you know, and somewhere in that mix, somebody said something to the effect, and I probably fine-tuned it for my own, you know, mental state, but if you hadn't have been so drunk, you would be dead. And I was like, sweet. If I hadn't have been drunk, I'd be dead. So get drunk, you know? I mean, it was just, that was the stupidity of it. You know, and that's how I looked at it, and it's, let's celebrate. You know, we got out of this car accident. Let's go down to Chancey's, or let's go to, you know, some frat house or this keg party or whatever it is. And, you know, that caught up with me pretty quickly in terms of academics. You go from probation to suspension. You go back and try again, and it just doesn't, you give up after the first month. So you got a free ride for about 4 months. But then the guilt starts getting on you. So, you know, it's just, God, I got to tell them, and it's like this is 4 or 5 months away. I'm not going to worry about it right now, you know. You're kind of roaming the campus, finding out who's going to drink on Monday night, who's going to, you know, you just develop your circuit with that, and that's, you know, that's what I did. And, you know, eventually I left school, not to return to that school, and, you know, I would move back into my parents' house. It was just like a rest area. I'm going to pull in and get myself straight and kind of work things out and that kind of stuff. And, you know, all I did really when I would do that is, like, try to clean myself up enough circumstantially and physically to get them off my back or get a license back or to get this or to do that. And then, you know, it was just right back out doing the same stuff. And, you know, it's I'm being oppressed, and I can't live under the, you know, and I'm now into my 20s, you know, and I can't be, you can't be telling me what to do, and so what if I didn't bring your car home last night, and so what if it reeks of beer, so what if your wine bottle gallon thing is gone, who has a gallon of wine in the refrigerator, it's just asking to be taken. You know, that kind of thing, and, you know, it is, so I would, you know, just these attitudes, and I would, like, try to get my way out, and I'd go down, and I'd do a couple of stints in the Fan, and the Fan is a haven for alcoholics, a haven, you know, I mean, answer an ad in the paper, it wasn't all on the internet back then, you know, it was just answer an ad in the paper and go talk to them and move right in. You know, you can walk to Lombardi Market, you can walk to this bar, you can walk anywhere you want to walk. You don't even need to drive, which was good because I didn't have a car then. And, you know, it was the same old thing. I would hold on to these, like, you know, not jobs that I would want to be doing today. You know, I don't want to manage a sub shop at night, 7 nights a week. I don't want to work... although it was a little fun, I don't want to work in a bakery on third shift, you know, and I don't want to install insulation. I don't want to, you know, I would have all these different jobs never lasting very long, you know, anywhere from a day to one I had almost a year. And, you know, I would bounce around apartments, I would, I started wrecking my credit without even knowing I was wrecking my credit or caring, really. You know, that was when Tallheimer's was still around, and they'd give anybody a credit card. Very first thing, I bought a watch and a stereo, and the watch soon got pawned for drinking money, and I held onto the stereo for as long as I could, and then that same thing happened to that. And so my drinking is progressing, to where I'm blacking out a lot. I think that's mostly amusing. It's not totally amusing anymore. I'm waking up with people I don't know. I'm waking up in places I don't remember going. I literally don't know the street. I'm like, who are these people? You got to walk out through the common room and there's six people eating cereal and watching cartoons. Who are these people? How did I get here? That kind of stuff. And, it was just going downhill. I'd make a couple of tries back at school, a part-time here, a part-time there. Drinking always took over with that, and not just in a general way. One specific economics class at VCU, I remember running into a guy that I went to high school with, and it was when they had CD jukeboxes, and CDs were, like, pretty new back then, and happy hour. And instead of sitting in it was a Tuesday, Thursday, so it was a long class. Instead of sitting in that class, we could just walk, diagonally through the intersection and go to this bar, I don't remember the name of it, and listen to the CD jukebox and have happy hour. So there went the class. Same thing with the classes at U of R, the same thing with classes at VCU again. It's just a continual, drinking is interfering and canceling out everything that I'm trying, and I don't even see it. And what I started to develop was this attitude of, I'm biding time, waiting for the maturity lottery numbers to arrive in my hand. Because I recognize that I'm going downhill, and I'm disappointing people, and I'm hurting people, and I'm, I can't keep a job. And that stuff is kind of obvious. And what made that more obvious to me was the friends of mine, a couple of which I still have, that I went to high school with and ran track and all that stuff, they were moving on. So there was a measuring stick, although I wouldn't admit it. Having responsible jobs, getting married, buying houses, moving over here, doing this, doing that. A vacation for me was if I could mooch off of you to go to wherever you were going. In a charity case, basically. That part was kind of obvious, and so the easy way for me to deal with that was, Richie did all this stuff in high school and worse. And now he's got this very important job and he lives in Wyndham. I'm just going to wait for my lottery number to come up. Not thinking I'm going to be rich or anything like that, but just like suddenly the circumstances and the stars would align and I would just poof out of it, and it didn't happen. I continued drinking more and more, sometimes 7, 8, 9 days in a row. It got to the point where I would have to take a day off from drinking. I just physically couldn't handle it. I mean, I probably could have, if you'd have said, here's $500, I would have taken the drink, don't get me wrong. But, I really couldn't handle, plus I liked being off alcohol for one day, because then the beer tasted like beer the day after that. Because it just tasted like, it wasn't even tasting like beer. I was very happy when they came out with the 2-liter wine coolers. I'm not a big wine fan, but it was something else I could drink that didn't taste like that. So I'm drinking and drinking and drinking, and it's obvious I've got to come up with an answer to the thing. And, every time I'm confronted by my family, and I'm trying to stay as far away from them as I can, but at the same time, I got to have some sort of base of usability. And that's what they were to me. I love them, but that's what I was doing. I taking their belongings, selling my dad's coin collection, getting his credit card, and walk, where you had to walk into the bank to get a cash advance. It wasn't no ATM. We just happened to have, I'm the third, so we had the same name. So I thought, carry my birth certificate. They'll give me the money. I'm going to buy this much pot, and I'm going to sell it, and I'm going to intercept the statement, and I'm going to, that whole long line of thinking. It never happened. you know, and that's just the way that I was doing things. So what am I going to do? You know, I'll come up with an answer. I'll do something. I'll straighten up. I'll do the military. I'll join the military. You know, this will be great. This will be an answer. I can get away from them. You know, I can take discipline to a point. You know, I mean, if you're a distance runner or you've been one, and you've had a really good coach, you can, and you've been successful, you've had that, or any other sports, I guess. But, you know, I was like, I can swing this because I was still physically in pretty good shape. And so I put this recruiter through all this rigmarole and all this stuff. I go down to the federal building. Well, the night before I went down to the federal building for my physical, a friend of mine is having a bachelor party. One of the brothers that I drank with for the first time, you know, and it's like, well, I can't miss that. And it's the very first time I can remember saying that I can clearly illustrate saying I said I was only going to drink this much, and I didn't. You know, the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. And I said, I'm going to go out, and, you know, I don't remember if it was I'm going to have one or two, or I'm really not going to drink, which kind of leaves it variable about how many I'll actually be able to have. And I got pretty drunk that night, but I always gauge that off of whether I remembered everything or not. You know, if I didn't remember everything, I was really drunk. If I remembered everything, it couldn't have been that bad. And I remembered everything, and I actually kind of held back. And I remember going down to the federal building, and it was like circuit training. You know, go to this station, and do this, and go to that room. And about the third or fourth thing, they had this breathalyzer room that they ushered me into. And they said, well, I went to this. And I blew in, and I really couldn't tell you what it read, but I blew into it again, and they told me I was out of there. You know, so my little answer of joining the Air Force and solving my life's problems, you know, and the answer for that was drinking. I walked out onto whatever the side street is on Broad, Marshall, or whatever. It doesn't matter. To some 7-Eleven nearby, bought some cheap beer, went into one of the alleys, drank that as fast as I could, and I had to call my dad to come pick me up. You know, and I don't even remember explaining to him what happened. You know, just down the tubes. There it is. You know, and I didn't have an answer. You know, I got a DUI. I've been pulled over a bunch of times. I didn't, you know, not having a job and money makes it difficult to retain an attorney or mount any kind of defense, really. I did the next best thing. Split town, you know, run. And so I went hitchhiking up and down Interstate 95 into South Carolina and North Carolina and bumming off people and, you know, I got arrested in South Carolina, and this is kind of funny, and then we'll get over the drinking. I'm in this little jail in Manning, South Carolina, which is a podunk place, and I apologize if you're from Manning, but it's, listen, I lived in Buena Vista. This place is smaller than that. I'm sitting in this, like, octagon-shaped cell with this guys that are going to be there 9 months, 14 months. It wasn't really a long-term place, but it was more than overnight. It's all they had. And before I got into the thrown in there with the three or four or five other guys, I'm turning my stuff into the lady behind the cage, and there's a little sign hanging down behind her that was like with a wood graving kit somebody's kid had made or something, and it said, "This is the county jail, not the Burger King, and we do it our way." Honest truth, I'm like, and I was like, this is awesome. You know, this isn't, I can't believe this is happening. This is going to be like in a book, or this is going to, you know. I mean, just totally detached from reality. Totally detached from reality. And the long and short of it is, I stayed sort of on the lam for a little big deal. You skip a court date on a DUI, but they will issue on you for that. And I came back a while later. And the lawyer said that it would be a great idea to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting before you went in front of the judge. And I said, okay. You know, I was pretty scared. I wasn't willing, it wasn't even a question of stopping drinking. It was just, what do I have to perform for you to see so that I can get out of this? And so I went to the AA meeting, 24 years old, dropped off by my mom. You know, I remember that so clearly at the Huguenot Road Baptist Church. You know, it's just, my mom's dropping me off. You know, I'm 24 years old. And I remember being in the meeting. Everybody was very nice to me. I remember a couple of women from that meeting, not girls that I was interested in. That would come later, but just a couple of women from that meeting. And that's it. You know, I don't remember a whole lot more to it. And I had to go through the whole ASAP thing. That was forced AA meetings and super counseling because I answered all the questions to the best of my ability, honestly. How much do you drink? How often do you drink? What happens, you know, all this stuff. And I'm looking at this girl who had to be just out of college, very cute. And I'm like, I'll impress her, you know, with all this, all these drunk, you know how we come in and we want to tell our drunks, you know. And so I'm laying all this out, and she's marking stuff down, and she sent me off to super counseling. And that kind of sucked. But, you know, the lady there was like, you know, you can't drink while you're going to these classes. And I was like, okay. You know, I solved that problem by taking Percocets. I won't drink for a little while. You know, and that wasn't really my cup of tea, but I would take anything or do anything just about at any time. I was just pretty much a pig when it came to that stuff. You know, the next couple of years, in and out of AA, like a carousel. You know, he gets on, I'm back at AA. You know, I'm humiliated because I'm a dummy. I go back to the same meetings with the same people. You know, I don't realize there's X amount of meetings and I could go all over town. I could even go out of town if I wanted to. You know, but I keep going back and taking, you know, oh God, they're gonna, you know, I got to pick up another white chip and stuff like that. And just, it's all about me, you know, and they really just wanted to help. Some of those people are still around. I mean, it's kind of amazing. So in and out, in and out, in and out, never did any steps. Never got a sponsor. I would get somebody that was willing to listen to my whining. You know, and I didn't call it whining then, but it was all, you know, it's, I'm already in a relationship. They say no relationships for the first year. You know, what counts? It's only 2 weeks old. Do I have, you know, I mean, everything was just, I dissected everything. Everything, you know, and I just didn't stay sober. And then April 17th, 1993, which happens to be my birthday, I went to an AA meeting, sat through the entire meeting, drove to the intersection of Courthouse and Hull Street to the Amoco. I stayed drunk for 3 days. By this time, by the way, I'd gotten a very good job. I was out of my parents' house. I had insurance, time to exercise, a couple of dates here and there. Life on the outside looked pretty good. So my whole idea of if these things changed, this would be different, gone. And I'm realizing that. And I wake up to my roommate, very good friend of mine, screaming at me, honking a piece of his wheelchair. He's a paraplegic. He broke his neck in high school in a diving accident. Very, very powerful guy. I mean, he's just spiritually one of the most awesome people I know. You better do something about your drinking or you're going to die. You know, and I'm just, something hit me. But what hit me was, I can't go back to AA. AA doesn't work for me. You know, I can look in retrospect now and tell you I never did anything but show up here. And why? And that's the truth. You know, I might have had a genuine conversation, but I really wasn't interested in doing anything. And, you know, he said that, and I said, well, I can't go to AA, so I went to this therapist or counselor or psychiatrist. I don't even know what she was, over at St. Mary's. Nice lady. And I told her the truth. I said, this is what I'm doing. And she said, you got to go to AA. You know, so I came back to AA, and I dreaded that white chip, and I hated doing that. I hated doing that. And the guy who was giving them out, Randy, they were out of white chips. And it's, I know I've told this story before, but it's hilarious because I'm sweating bullets. And he doesn't know what to do. And it seemed like a half an hour until he figured out, I'll pull a quarter out of my pocket and give it to him. You know, so that's my last white chip was a quarter. And You know, I didn't know at that time that I wasn't going to drink up until this point. I only knew that, you know, I was collapsing on the inside rather than on the outside. And there wasn't, I didn't have any other ideas. You know, I felt better when I came to AA. I'm not saying I felt great. I felt better. And, you know, I just plodded along, and I ran across this girl, and I started kind of following her around, and it was pretty messed up. She's my wife now. I'm Mr. Valerie. Did I say that? Just kidding. But I started following her around, you know, and she's like going to this big book meeting over at the Rebos, and I'm like, I don't need to go to any big book meeting. Why do I need a big book meeting? You know, I have the Sunday meeting and the Tuesday meeting, and it's loud, and it's fun, and it's, you know, we go out for ice cream, and there's nothing wrong. That's great. You know, but it was like, then it became her, or, you know, her in the meeting, or not her, and not the meeting. And then, you know, I went to the meeting, you know, and funny thing happened sitting in there, and I don't know how long it was. It wasn't a long time. But it was the most weird mix of people I've ever seen in any AA meeting in Richmond. I mean, because there's still people that are sober today, like Ross was there, Sammy was there, my sponsor Al, Allison, they weren't married yet, and a couple of other people, and not people that all run together or part of the same group, but everybody was in this one place. And people were talking about, with differing levels of volume and intensity and all that other stuff, but they were talking about what's in this book and talking about the solution and talking about taking the actions. And it really was the first time that I was open enough to hear that this was something more than just a comfort tool to make me feel better and to get me out of trouble. That, like, wait a minute, this is like a recipe to not have to drink anymore and be happy. Yeah, that's what it is. Oh, you know, I mean, it was like I didn't have any idea. You know, I remember walking up to my sponsor the first time. I don't know if it was the first time that I met him, but it's the first time I talked to him in earnest. And I said, I don't know if I've ever done a first step, a second step. I said, I don't know, and I know I'm going to drink again. And if you've been in and out of AA, you know when you get to that point. It's like you could be sitting in here right now going, I can't wait for this to shut up and the meeting to end so I can get down to the 7-Eleven. You know, that's where I was at. And I walked up to him and I told him that. You know, and he spent, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes talking to me, and he became my sponsor. And he started requiring me, and he intimidated me. And I mean, I'm, you know, arm around and hugs and all this other stuff. I joke with him now a lot, you know, but he was very intense back then. And, you know, that's exactly what I needed. You know, he had expectations on me that if I was going to take up his time with my phone calls, with all the other people that he sponsored and a job and a house and all that other stuff, that if he said, okay, and he worked it out with me, 8 o'clock on Tuesday, I'm picking a time out of the air, 8 o'clock on Tuesdays work for you to be able to call me? Yeah, yeah, that works great. You know, 8:20, 8:30, 8:45 rolls around, you know, hey, sorry I'm late, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, it was just, that didn't last long. He didn't put up with a lot of that, and I'm thankful for it, you know, because it's not, it's so cliche, but the rules don't apply to me. You know, they do apply to me. They really do, and it's for my benefit, not to punish me, and that's just a change in perspective that I've gotten through Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship. You know, he had set number of meetings I had to go to. I was expected to start going to conventions with him. And I'm going to go all the way down to Georgia to hear, you know, I got a book right here with a bunch of meetings in it. Can't we just do that, you know, kind of stuff. But, man, I am so glad he did. He's, like, giving me tapes left and right. And then asking me questions. Did you hear Frank talk about, or did you hear, you know, Bob talk about, oh, yeah, yeah, you know. And then I'd be listening to two or three tapes in a row, so that, oh, wow, you know, that kind of stuff, playing catch-up and that kind of thing. But, you know, that man saved my life. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I mean, he could have been somebody else, but he wasn't. You know, I'm saying it could have been one of you, or it could have been somebody we don't, you know. Another solid member of AA could have done the same thing. For me, it happened to be him. And, you know, he took me through the steps, and the big thing about the stereotypical approach, you know, am I an alcoholic? Okay. You know, I mean, what else am I going to say? No. I know what that means. That means I'm out the door again. So do I understand it? No, but okay. I mean, I know I drink too much, and I know I pay a heavy price from drinking, and I know I alienate people and cause problems. Okay. You know, do you believe that a power greater than you can help you? And I'd been to enough AA meetings, and I probably would have said it differently then. It's not like I came in here with a bunch of perspective, and it may not be that good now. But, you know, I could see that something was going on. I said before that I felt a little better when I left AA, and that was the truth. And I could see people, when I kept returning and seeing some of the same people there night after night after night, faithfully, you know, welcoming me, glad you're here, all that other stuff. No one time made that big of a deal, but all of them together made an impression that something was happening here. And so, yeah, I can go with that. You make a decision to go through with the rest of the steps? Sure. Okay? Write your 4-step. Here's the instructions. Last minute. You know, but I did it. And I went out to do a 5th step. And really what I was afraid of wasn't being, I was willing to be almost completely honest with somebody. What I didn't want to share was stuff out of my sexual inventory that nobody needs to know about that. You know, they don't need to know about this, some of those situations, you know, and I had enough where it wasn't like that was going to be empty. You know, it was 3 or 4 things or however many it was. And in the process of this 5th step, he shared some stuff with me, and those things, which I had not written down on paper, were some of the first things out of my mouth. The rest of it was easy street. You know, I look back at that, and I'm like, what was the big deal? I mean, I know I'm in a different position now, but it's like, I thought that, you know, that terminal uniqueness, that I'm just so different, that I've been extra bad, or whatever it is, it is just BS. You know, I can say BS here, can't I? Thanks. Billy will give me demerit after the meeting. I'm just playing. The, you know, but it was just, I just shouldn't have said that. Now I lost my place. Yeah, I know. I don't want to be stuck on that, though. Oh, never mind. The, but I didn't have to be, yeah, it didn't, I didn't have to be, you know, looking back, it really was pretty common stuff. You know, it wasn't like I'm going to do untold amounts of time. This was personal stuff. You know, I mean, I've done enough criminal activity, but this was personal stuff. And that was the stuff that I was holding up. I mean, I'd tell you that I embezzled. I'd tell you I committed arson. I'd tell you I, you know, did whatever. And I didn't really want to, but I knew I had a do something, but this other stuff, you know, and it just came out. And, you know, a little ways after that, I felt it didn't hit me at once, but I started to feel like less nervous in meetings. I wasn't sweating as much. You know, things seemed to be a little better between other people at meetings and myself. And it wasn't that it was bad, but it was just more comfortable all the way around, you know, and it timed in with that. Not like a light switch, but that came. And, you know, the amends thing with, you know, thank God for sponsorship with that. There's some stuff that was pretty obvious. I stole the money my mom hid out of one of her shoes in the closet and went drank with it. That was $150. I pay that back. I own up to it. I face her, you know, or my dad with the credit card or whatever, all these other things, you know. But at the top of my list in here was all the wrongs with these women that I dated. field of opportunity in my own mind. You know, maybe we can drum something up here. Maybe there's like sort of some reconciliation. Don't want it there. I mean, that was kind of my thinking. And I don't mean that like that was the forefront and nothing but that. But that was there. You know, I was brand new to this stuff and not well. And, you know, so he made it pretty clear. You know what? This one that you're talking about here, you don't have a right to go into her life and turn it upside down so that you feel better. You know, I mean, that really hit me. Like, that's exactly what I'm doing. You know, and the funny thing is, a couple of months before I got married in 2000, this girl called me out of the blue, and I got to make amends to her. You know, I didn't have to go hunt her down, and I haven't talked to her since. And I wouldn't have done it on the phone, except I had no other choice. I was trying to set up a meeting, and you know, I said a prayer, and the only answer I got is, "You may not get another chance." You know, her reply was, "That's kid stuff." You know, and I'm like, I've been hanging myself up for this. This is ridiculous. You know, that's how poorly I can be when it comes to the thinking department. You know, the whole thing with sobriety, I kind of looked at it like, you know, I've done the steps and I'm on this path and I'm in the middle of AA. You know, and life was going pretty good. I mean, I had a good job. I had a nice place to live. All of the deficits that I was running before were gone. You know, but it's funny when things like that happen. There's always I want something else. You know, or I want things differently, or I want, you know, and it just can be insidious at times. I've grown up a lot in AA, in my attitudes and my maturity, and I got a long way to go. But, you know, getting married, I never thought I'd be married. Really, I didn't, and I didn't see a lot of use for it. I like to talk about it, because if I said no, that would scare people away. You know, I kind of let the scent get out there a little bit, but we're not committing here. And, you know, I'm going to tell this the way that it's told to me. Valerie was getting ready to leave. You know, and in typical alcoholic fashion, in 3 days, I decided to ask her to marry me, buy an engagement ring, plan, you know, the location was the place she was taking me, and did all this, and she agreed, and of course we got married. And, you know, from that moment forward, it's been a complete learning process for me about how to be in a relationship, which I thought I was the king at. You know, I could write poetry, I could make you feel better, I could carry the load, I could, you know, what a bunch of crap. You know, I mean, it's really been a learning experience for me. Some very amazing moments and some very big fits of self, you know, in there. I remember early on in that I was making amends to her for something. I don't even remember what it was. And she said, "Stop. Stop. You got to change your behavior. You can't apologize again." You know, I would try to clean it up, and then I'd keep doing the same thing. You know, and I've seen that. I'm not as bad at that today, but I can be that way. And that never really goes away in me. You know, I don't even like that phrase, but I told her I'd use it. Not for this talk. We had a son. She gave birth to him. That there, I get both points across. I didn't have a baby. You did. His name is Beck, and he came along about, I don't know, close to 20 months ago, and it was a surprise. You know, I had been a pretty good stepfather to her son Nicholas, who's now 21. And I'd known him since he was 2 and some odd months. That's been a complete, has completely changed our lives. Not just having a kid, but I went, and Justin and I were talking about this a little bit on the way up here. I went from being the larger income producer in the family, and I was at a job for 18 years, almost 18 years. And I'm now the Manny. Mr. Mom, whatever you want to call it. You know, and it's been a trip. You know, it's my wife is the income producer in the family, and I stay home and watch that. And I've been doing that for a while now, and it's, you know, I certainly have learned things about patience and tolerance with him, and he's, you know, he's crazy. And just like I, when my mom laughs when she comes to me, yeah, get what you deserve, from it, you know, at least I think that's what she's saying, you know. But I have to practice this stuff, these things that we learn here, with him. Because I get to the end of the evening, you know, and I have to ask myself those questions. And it's like, you know what? I could have been more patient with him. You know what? I could have. And not about beating myself up. It's just about being honest. You know? And so I've had a lot of those little lessons along the way. Some of the funny stuff, you know, it's like, I mean, I'm totally good, and I think my wife, as far as I know, is totally good with the situation, but it's like we go to the playground, we go to Toys R Us, I'm looking for diaper deals, I'm talking about, dude, this baby food is really good. He really likes it, you know, it's like all my, and they're just momentary relationships are with other moms, you know, and it's just funny how it works that way, you know. It's like, oh, no, you've got to buy the bigger box of diapers to get the free wipes, you know. And that kind of stuff. And I'm just like, sometimes I'll walk out of those situations and I'm like, what have I become? This is not what I pictured, you know. But all along the way, you know, and continuing to today, I still actively sponsor guys, and we're involved in each other's lives. You know, we're not, it's not, I have a few phone checker-inners, but not many. And even some of the out-of-town stuff, you know, we'll come in and visit and make an effort to do that. But, you know, we do stuff together sometimes, and when we can, we spend as much time as we need to talking on the phone. And it's like this, you know, if I didn't have that, and I'm sitting at home with a nearly two-year-old all the time. Because I complained to my wife not too long ago, and I'll wrap this up very quickly. I know I'm very close to the edge. You know, you get to spend all day talking to adults. And I'm talking to a 20-month-old. You know, and enjoying it. You know, of course, when I'm saying it, that's not part of it, but, you know, the whole, I've really come to appreciate my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous and the guys that I sponsor and being sponsored and being in the middle and doing stuff. And what's really neat is, you know, I would have told you, let me forge that out so that I can get some relief. And really what has happened is, you know, even my wife, who is the busiest person I know, I'm sure there's somebody busier, but she's the busiest person I know, you know, is like, you're going to the movies with Justin and Tom on this night, you know. I mean, it's not all like that, but that happens, you know, where she's like, you got to get out and do some stuff, you know, like that. And so being, I'm kind of trapped in AA. I can't get away, which is great. I can't get away from not doing this stuff and not being a part of it because it becomes too obvious. And I think I'm the kind of person that if I had the autonomy and the separateness and I lived by myself and, you know, I didn't have these factors like other AA members on the cul-de-sac where we live or a couple more right around the corner or ones that'll see me at the grocery store, you know, with my wife. If I didn't have that stuff, you know, I don't know that I would be staying here. And I'm not saying it's not attractive enough. I'm a lazy guy, you know, and I've been disciplined by AA, not wit, but disciplined hopefully into a better person in Alcoholics Anonymous to be part of rather than separate from, which is, you know, the whole direction I was going in before I got here. And I just want to thank you for listening and for having me. That's it.